Eartha Kitt nervous?
I'm nervous anyway before I go on to do anything. That's why I get very, I guess, very quiet. People think I'm very difficult, but it's not that. I'm scared.
Eartha Kitt died yesterday. There was no one who could sell a song or project her personality like the feisty, tiny, nervous Eartha Kitt, who could land a note like a butterfly.
When your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke that's in your eyes.
She gave us 81 years and tears in our eyes on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 26th, and I actually saw Eartha Kitt perform last year, and she was just so powerful, a little magical performer.
81-year-old dynamo. Good morning, Adora.
So we'll have more on that. Also today, we're asking the question of how poverty affects the brain. You'll hear how one researcher believes it does. And Christmas is over. We'll show you a green way to get rid of the tree and all the other holiday leftovers. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Parts of the West are in for a snowy Friday. A winter storm system is moving across the country. Colorado looks to get the worst of it. 20 inches of snow could cover part of the state's western zone, and winds could reach 80 miles an hour. The blizzard conditions have proved dangerous for skiers. Several are dead or missing from mountains in the region. Great concern this morning that new fighting could break out in the Middle East. Palestinian militants in Gaza have stepped up rocket attacks. Now Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warns Israel is ready to attack if militants don't stand down.
I can tell you, we have the power. We have enormous power. We can do things which will be devastating.
The Gaza territory is primarily controlled by Hamas.
It is the day after Christmas, as I said, and retailers around the country are trying to lure you in with sales and deals in stores and online. They need your money because early numbers indicate the holiday shopping season was a bust. New data from the tracking group SpendingPulse shows total retail sales could be down as much as 8%. For some retailers, holiday shopping accounts for half of their yearly sales. Overseas, China is the latest nation to join the fight against pirates off the coast of Somalia. Several Chinese warships are on the way now. Other countries have sent gunboats recently to secure the busy shipping lane. Just yesterday, German forces stopped a hijacking there.
Well, Kobe Bryant is happy this morning.
Yeah, just from the challenge of it. You know, it's a team that's been playing so well. But at the same time, they did win 19 in a row, so they were due for one kind of malaise kind of a game.
One malaise kind of a game. That is right. The Boston Celtics win streak is over, and it was ended by the Lakers. We want to ask you what your favorite streak is in sports or anything. What is your favorite streak?
Oh, that's a good one.
The Celtics got a 19-1 club record. It's not even close to the NBA record for streaks, but what's your favorite streak? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Of course, Wall Street took yesterday off. Traders are back to work today looking for bargains like everybody else. I like that one, streaks.
I think that's an excellent idea. You really got those gray cells in my brain are working
months.
Right now. What's your favorite streak?
Streak going.
Well, we do because we're in 30-plus stations now.
That's right. The markets.
Markets.
That's why you've got to say markets.
Markets. Okay.
Sure.
We're on a streak here at The Takeaway. We want to hear what streak you're on. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On this day following Christmas, you may be having that sort of morning after feeling. But Republicans have been having that feeling for quite some time now. A number of landmark events in this year make it fairly urgent for the conservative movement in the United States and the Republican Party in particular to think about what the future is and how to get there. It's a venerable organization, of course, but it's faced onslaught of criticism, real setbacks in the election, and even the death this year of Paul Weyrich, the important founder of the Heritage Foundation, suggests the conservative movement and the Republican Party are looking for a new vision or perhaps attempting to restore an old vision. Is it get back to basics or move forward? David Frum joins us. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. David, thanks for being part of the program today.
Thank you.
What do you think the urgency is from your perspective as a conservative, as someone who's worked in a number of Republican administrations, to this kind of retooling or revisioning of both the conservative movement and the Republican Party in 2009?
Well, a lot of Republicans and conservatives would say, what's the problem? John McCain got 46% of the vote maybe 47, depending on how you count, this last election. That's a lot better than Bill Clinton got in 1992. There was a recession on, so, yeah, we took a bump. But, we're well-positioned to do well next time, as happened. You know, we did well in 94 after 92. We did well in 1980 after 1976 and so on. Here, let me just go through what's wrong with that way of thinking, which is, at the moment, the dominant way of thinking on the Republican and conservative side. What's wrong with it is when you look more carefully at who voted for John McCain and who did not, what you see is that Republicans have lost the support of the better-educated voters in America and the younger voters in America. In 1984, Ronald Reagan won 20-somethings by 20 points, and he won first-time voters by 21 points. Barack Obama won those same two categories of young people by even bigger margins this time. No Republican has won in the under-30 vote since 1988.
Wow.
Republicans used to rack up big totals among the college-educated. Among whites with college degrees, the elder George Bush beat Michael Dukakis by 20 points in 1988. Today, Barack Obama won the college-educated. And while John McCain won whites with college degrees, he did so very, very narrowly by I think, 2 points. And this at a time when the number of whites with college degrees is growing. As recently as 1990, only 20% of white Americans had a college degree. Today it's almost 30%.
Well, that's a devastating indictment of the, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a beer with George W. Bush strategy of attempting to identify the electorate with your candidate if the educated electorate is retreating from the GOP.
The GOP has been winning bigger and bigger shares of a dwindling demographic.
Hmm.
What happened in the Reagan years is Ronald Reagan made this great breakthrough into a part of the country that had once been the base of the Democratic Party, the white working class. That is, whites who are not poor, but who didn't have a college degree. And that created the conservative majorities of the 1980s and early 1990s. The problem is that that group of people is shrinking relative to the rest of the country because the country is becoming less white, and the white part of the country is becoming better educated and less working class.
And David,
isn't
that...
So the future looks a little ominous for this approach.
But isn't that then reflective of the dissatisfaction that many Americans have with what the Republican Party, the conservative movement, has come to represent? I mean, let's look at this legacy of President Bush, two wars and a terrible economy.
As President Bush himself said, he said, this is not a presidency where you wave your hand and ride off into the sunset. No, it's been a very traumatic time with a lot of bad news. But there's been a lot of good news, too. A very long expansion, a lot of jobs created. I don't think this is a negative verdict driven exactly by people's reaction to George Bush or recent events, because it starts, you can see these trends all starting in the late 1990s. It has been since the late 1990s or mid-1990s that Republicans have been losing the young and have been losing their traditional franchise among the educated. And it's been since the middle 1990s that their share of the less educated vote among white people has been going up and up and up.
So what do you think
so
explains it?
We have it? a deep, long-term secular trend.
So what do you think explains that?
What do I think explains it?
Yeah, why is that? Why is this trending in that direction?
There are a lot of very complicated reasons, but if I were to just pick out one,
mm-hmm.
I would say what happened in the 1990s was the Democratic Party moved to the center on economics. The Democrats had always had a kind of social democratic smell to them. They'd always been like the British Labor Party since half a century anyway, like the British Labor Party, like Scandinavia. That was what they looked to. And so Americans who were winners in the market system, who had property, who had jobs, who had succeeded in a competitive economy, looked at the Democrats as a danger and a threat. Well, in the 1990s, the Democrats moved away from that social democratic tendency, and they made themselves more acceptable to Americans who were successful in the market system at a time when the market system was winning all the arguments.
Well,
and that meant the argument between the parties tended to focus on cultural issues, and there Republicans represented a shrinking part of the country, and Democrats spoke to a growing part of the country.
I guess what troubles me about that argument, David, is that you're talking about Democratic failures and sort of broad demographic shifts that don't appear to be favoring the Republicans in this decade. Yet, maybe there's this really simple way of looking at it. What happened was the Republicans had an opportunity after 9/11 to basically change the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world, and didn't, and the setback was devastating. And the Republicans had the opportunity after the Clinton surplus to basically extend in an extraordinary way the expansion, and indeed instead lost it in a way that's historical going back to the 1930s. You don't have to go much beyond those two gigantic setbacks to understand where the GOP is at this point.
I'm not sure I would agree with your characterization of those two events, but it doesn't matter because they don't make sense of the chronology. This decline of support for the Republicans,
it's really not about chronology, it's about perception. And that's the issue, and that's where the Republicans have to live. What's the message that's going to reverse that perception?
The decline of support for the Republicans among the young starts not in 2002 or not 1999 with the surpluses. It starts in the year 1990. The decline for Republicans among the college educated starts about 1990.
But doesn't it get cumulative at some point, though? And I guess the question is, what do you think is going to turn the boat around today, or what can the conservative movement, the GOP, do in 2009, you think, to address some of those declines?
Well, that's a very good question. I would suggest, I've written a book about this, and I'm launching a new website about this, so this is going to be a big theme of my future work. I think there are really four things that Republicans need to begin to do. This is going to be, we didn't get into the trouble quickly, we won't get out quickly, but we need to focus on those people we have lost, and we need to reconnect with younger America. And so I would propose this formula. One, we need a more relevant economic message. The message of tax reductions, which was very important in the 1970s and 1980s when the personal income tax had really gotten out of line for a large numbers of people. We're not going to abandon that message. We remain a party of low taxes, but that's not where the pressure on middle incomes is coming from today. It's coming from the problem of rising health care costs. We need to have an economic message that has that puts health care and health care reform where taxes used to be. We need an environmental message, not because the environment is the issue for very many people, but because for millions of people, you're not even acceptable unless you have an environmental message. It's the way national security was in the 50s and 60s. You can't play politics unless you're sound on national security. That's going to be the case for the environment of the future. We need a more modulated social message, not to cease to be a conservative party, not to cease to be a majority pro-life party, but so there's room for people for whom that issue is less important. It has to be possible for us to have a pro-choice running mate, even if the head of the ticket is usually pro-life. Hmm. It can't be that no one who has a pro-choice view is ever allowed on a Republican ticket ever again, and that we favor a human life amendment that would ban abortion across the country for everybody, and where we seem to be talking about gay rights or against gay rights all the time. Americans, are non-discriminatory people.
And number
we
four?
Have to have, and number four, we have to have an ethic of competence in government. We want smaller government, but we have to stop pretending we're going to make the government go away. We're not going to make it go away, and that part of it that still is there has to work better, and we have to show that we care. That means no more Harriet Myers, no more Brownie, no more Sarah Palin.
All right. Well, that's a full plate for any website launch or a book. David Frum, his forthcoming book will be called The New Majority. And when do you launch the website?
Sorry, the website is called newmajority.com. The book has been out for a year, and it's called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again.
Thanks, David. David Frum joined us from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., where he is a resident fellow. No more Palin, no more Brownie. Well, that's a good first step for the GOP.
Yeah, no more Harriet.
Yeah. Harriet Myers, that's right. I didn't know who he was talking about there for a moment. That's how quickly she's receded. So the Republicans had a streak going there. The Celtics had a streak going until last night. The Lakers sort of put it into the history books. But what's your favorite streak, sports or otherwise? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. No streaking, please. This is family radio.
You can eat. email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, we're asking you about your favorite streaks, sports streaks or otherwise. The Celtics lost their career record streak last night to the Lakers. Their 19-1 record is going to stay in the books.
Disappointing.
Yeah, Kobe Bryant kind of stomped them out there in L.A. But what's your favorite streak?
Yeah, hi. This is Bill from Hawthorne, New Jersey. And I think the penultimate streak in sports was Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. Where at the end of that 54-game hitting streak, he missed one game and then went on and ripped off another long streak.
In fact, that is called the streak, DiMaggio streak. Fabulous.
Thank you, John.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to continue our discussion of sports, beginning with the Celtics, with our own Jay Cowett, who is the person on this show, I think it's fair to say, who tracks sports for us. He's sort of a cross between a Uber expert and an Uber fan, I think. He's also our broadcast engineer here on the program. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem. It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
Someone's got to do it. What's your favorite streak?
My favorite streak, well, you know, our caller just mentioned the DiMaggio streak, which has all the...
That's the famous
You
one,
know,
yeah.
the hullabaloo about right. it. But Johnny Vandermeer, who played for the Cincinnati Reds in the first half of the last century, had two straight no-hitters in 1938.
Oh, that's...
And to me, that's the most impossible streak to break out of anyone. It's also the
right.
shortest. It's only
short,
two, which
right,
makes
right,
it
right.
kind of poetic.
But but anyone who knows anything about baseball knows two no-hitter. One no-hitter is amazing enough, but two in a row is a mind-blower.
And
a
to break
dropper.
It, someone would have to pitch right. three in a row, right. which is almost impossible.
Right. And nobody pitches three games in a row anyway anymore. It even makes it to the sixth inning anymore. Well, let's talk basketball. What do you think the significance is of this Lakers-Celtics game yesterday, which seemed like a replay of the NBA Finals and all of a sudden made it look, even though the Celtics seemed unstoppable, like, wow, we could have a really interesting playoffs this year?
Oh, I think it makes it great. You know, you had the Lakers-Celtics last year, and the thing that makes great rivals is carrying it over. It's not just having one year where they're up against each other. It's having multiple years or a couple years in a row where they carry this over and they carry this anger and hate over. And you could tell last night the Lakers wanted this. The Lakers wanted revenge. You could see Paul Gasol, who had a rough finals last year against the Celtics, came out and went 3-for-3 from the floor in the final quarter, 3-for-3 from the free throw line, was banging his chest.
Mm.
You could tell they're into this. It's good for tepid NBA fans. You want to see
right.
these two teams as your rivals. You want to see the Celtics. You want to see the Lakers. And you want to see it be competitive. Because, quite frankly, the finals last year, you know, the Celtics
yeah.
you know, ran over them.
Celtics
a little bit.
Just stomped. And what did Kobe say last night? He said it was time. They were due to have a malaise game.
A malaise
game.
Kind of a game.
A malaise
and
kind
I'm,
of game.
I'm interested in that, too. When you have a team like the Celtics who won so many in a row, who have the best start in NBA history at 27-3 now, does one loss throw them off the tracks a little bit because they're so not used to it happening?
Well, it's early. I mean, people like to say the NBA has two seasons. There's the regular season and there's the playoffs, which go endlessly. But there was more basketball this holiday weekend than there's been in decades. I mean, they really concentrated a lot of games both yesterday on Christmas and all through the weekend.
Well, I think they see it as kind of their window to really pick up a whole bunch of fan base that they're losing to the NFL right now. You know, NFL has Thanksgiving, and they've made that a three-game day. And now with the NBA, they have an opportunity where there's not baseball going on, where football's nearing the end of the season, where nobody watches hockey anyway. So they have
stop,
an opportunity.
Stop now.
So they have an opportunity to really get out there and show what they're about, and they put their best game probably of the regular season on the day.
All right, well, let's shift over to the NFL because a lot of people are going to be paying attention. The huge sports headlines are NFL this weekend, and a lot of the diehard fans of teams like the Jets and the Baltimore Ravens and the Miami Dolphins and the Patriots are going to be doing that complicated end-of-season NFL math, which determines how the heck you get into the playoffs. The Jets have probably the most complicated situation here.
Well, insofar as they have to deal with a lot of emotions to get where they want to be anyway. To get into the playoffs, the Jets have to win and then hope for a New England or Baltimore loss, but they also have to go against their old friend, Chad Pennington, who they let go to Miami in the preseason when they signed Brett Favre. And I saw somebody compare Brett Favre to a Ferrari and Chad Pennington to a Pinto at the beginning of the year, that the Jets threw out the Pinto to take in this Ferrari.
Well, what they're discovering is that the Ferrari was from the 1950s, apparently. That's the problem.
I don't know if that's so fair. Favre has had a very good season, or at least a better season than what many expected. I mean, 9-6 is respectable.
It's interesting, and he brought the Jets from a 4-win team to now a 9-win team, and he's made the Pro Bowl, but the story behind that is that maybe he doesn't deserve to be there. Chad Pennington, who came from the Jets and went to Miami, has brought a 1-15 team to almost the brink of a division title, and he's also played better ball. He's thrown less interceptions. He's handled a very efficient Miami offense that's only had 13 turnovers all year. Brett Favre has had 6 turnovers himself in the last 4 games.
Well, you can hear it in their voices. Let's play Favre and then Pennington, and you can decide for yourself who's the whiny one and who's the one who's on top of the world at this point.
Exactly.
Whether I walk away today, 3 years ago, I can't look back and say, boy, that's one thing I wanted to do. One play, one season is not going to, it's not going to make a difference.
Now that's Favre.
That's Favre.
Not exactly.
Whiny Favre.
Not exactly the leader you want. And here's Pennington from this week.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. Our whole team's excited about having the chance to be able to have one shot into the playoffs. And that's what you work so hard for the whole season to get to this point, to have an opportunity to play an extra game.
And the Dolphins win, they're in, right?
Dolphins win, they're in, and they win their division, which would be a record turnaround. They were the worst team in the league last year. They get Barcells in, they get Tony Sperano in from the Cowboys, and they've turned it all around.
And again, just like we were talking about with the NBA, this is a great rivalry. This is what the NFL needs. This is what sports needs right now in this complex, sort of disturbing economic environment. Jay Cowett, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, guys.
And stay back behind the glass, all right? I guess it disturbs me when you come around the door there.
You got it.
And now we got some headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. It's going to be a whiteout in parts of the West as a winter storm system moves across the country. Colorado looks to get the worst of it. 20 inches of snow could cover part of the state's west, and winds could reach up to 80 miles an hour. The blizzard conditions have proven dangerous for skiers. Several are dead or missing from mountains in the region. China is the latest nation to join the fight against pirates off the coast of Somalia. Several Chinese warships are on their way now, and other countries have sent gunboats recently to secure the busy shipping lane. Just yesterday, German forces stopped a hijacking there. Across Asia today, it marks 4 years since a tsunami killed nearly a quarter of a million people in a dozen countries. The recovery effort has cost some $5.5 billion. And we've been talking about slowing holiday sales, and we won't know the final numbers until January. But if the preliminary numbers hold up, there could be some layoffs at retail chains. Britt Beamer of America's Research expects big job cuts in 2009.
I would say that probably 20 to 30% of most chain stores this Christmas underperformed, and that's a recipe for disaster long term.
And if you're a bargain hunter, the slow holiday season could pay off for you. Lots of sales today.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Scientists have long suspected that poverty affects children's brains. In recent years, they've begun to use sophisticated imaging tools and other methods to understand exactly how that process works. Professor Martha Farah, director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania, has just written an article for a scientific journal reviewing recent research on the issues, and she joins us. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks.
So, what did you discover?
Well, we discovered that there is a burgeoning literature just in the last few years. Suddenly, cognitive neuroscientists have discovered socioeconomic status. You know, for most of the history of cognitive neuroscience, we were studying the typical brain, which actually meant the brain of the college sophomore who you could, you know, easily get into the lab and, you know, scan for $20 subject payment. But people are now more interested in how different normal human beings differ from one another. And one important dimension along which people's life experiences differ, and it turns out their brain function differs, is socioeconomic status.
What comes to mind immediately would be malnutrition, for example.
Yeah, people usually assume that the causes of these differences in brain development are physical causes, because the brain is a physical thing, and you'd expect things like nutrition, also exposure to environmental toxins like lead, to account for the differences, because poor kids are less well-nourished, exposed to more lead, and so forth. And certainly those physical factors play a role, but probably the biggest factors are actually psychological.
You want to explain that?
Yeah, sure. Poor kids live in more stressed households, and we are beginning to understand how psychological stress gets transduced, if you will, by the body into physical conditions. Stress affects all different kinds of aspects of your physical health, but also it affects your brain and your mind.
In what ways?
Well, myriad ways. Probably the most relevant in terms of child development is that very young creatures of all kinds, animals and people, don't have their own systems in place at birth for regulating their own stress levels. So when a baby is upset and distressed, it's the human mother or the mama rat who soothes the human baby or the rat pup. And that process enables the young creature's own stress regulation systems to continue developing normally and to eventually sort of take over from the mother.
I'm wondering, when you image the brain, where do you see much of this activity taking place based on the current research?
Based on the data we have so far, it looks like two areas in particular are affected. Prefrontal cortex, which is important for attention, self-control, what people sometimes call executive function, and also the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that is important for learning and memory, and also for regulation of the stress response. So this makes perfect sense if you look back at the animal literature, where people have manipulated the amount of stress and the type of mothering that baby rats get. They find that the changes as those rats mature are in prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, and it looks from the human data like we're seeing similar kinds of changes in people.
If you're seeing these changes in the brain and you're connecting those issues of poverty to affecting the brain, what's the consequence of that, and are the consequences short-term or long-term?
The consequences, as far as we can tell, are long-term, which is not to say irreversible, but without any kind of intervention, they seem to last into adulthood, and they influence people's academic achievement, occupational achievement, you know, a success at work. And really, we've known for decades that there's a correlation between socioeconomic status and academic and work achievement, and this is beginning to show us the mechanism by which growing up poor results in those outcomes. And let me just mention that there's terrible sort of vicious cycles and snowballing effects at work here, because for anybody, trying to get themselves out of poverty is a huge task, a daunting task that any of us would, you know, have to use all of our mental resources to accomplish. And the horrible irony is that the kids who most need those resources are, to an extent, deprived of them.
I think in many ways the neurological mapping of the mechanisms of those consequences would give us some tools for possibly compensating for some of the natural stresses that are going to occur in socioeconomically troubled neighborhoods and communities, and maybe allow kids to develop more normally because we're anticipating the stresses of poverty.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it has real practical importance because it points to aspects of childhood experience that should be targeted for change. I think it also has a kind of rhetorical importance, if you will. You know, I think there's some people out there who think, oh, well, you know, it's all very nice and sweet and sentimental to care about poor children. And, you know, of course, they're very sweet and we want everybody to have an equal opportunity and justice is nice. But if you put it in terms of, in effect, a public health issue, these adverse environments that kids are growing up in are really having a physical impact on their bodies and minds. I think it makes the issue more than just nice to try to make society more fair to poor people if you can afford it.
Professor Martha Farah, thank you. Professor Farah is director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. Femi Oke is now here with the Fedlines.
Fedlines?
I could do the Fedlines if you like.
Hemlines. Hemlines.
I could do the Femlines. What's the time?
Sorry, Femi.
21 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. Now, it was a slow day for Asian markets. They finished mixed. The markets in Hong Kong, as well as major markets in Europe, all closed for the holidays. Oh, reminds me, happy Boxing Day to everybody who knows what that means.
Oh, happy Boxing Day.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. The Nikkei finished up on the day as investors picked up downbeaten shares. The reason for that is the economy in Japan is heading deeper into recession. New figures released today show that industrial production plunged by the biggest margin ever recorded, while the jobless rate jumped and household spending fell. Israeli leaders have made their strongest warning so far to the Palestinian group Hamas to stop firing rockets into Israel. Now, speaking in an interview with Al Arabiya television, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert said that he would not hesitate to strike Hamas and another militant group, Islamic Jihad, in the Gaza Strip.
I can tell you, we have the power. We have enormous power. We can do things which will be devastating.
Meanwhile, today, Israel has reopened a border crossing to the Gaza Strip and have begun letting in humanitarian supplies. Now, from India to Indonesia, communal prayers, shared meals and candlelight vigils are being held to remember the victims of the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. What you're listening to is some Buddhist monks chanting in Malaysia in a memorial service for the victims of that tsunami. The killer waves triggered by an earthquake struck a dozen countries and killed some 230,000 people. That was 4 years ago today. And that's a look at your news headlines for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Or the Fedlines.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. A tense situation continues today in the Gaza Strip. Israel has reopened three border crossings with Gaza and is delivering humanitarian aid despite continued mortar fire from Hamas fighters. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has hinted he may be preparing for a military offensive in response to those mortar firings. For more, we turn to BBC Middle East correspondent Katia Adler, who is in Jerusalem. Welcome, Katia.
Hello.
Why did Israel open the three border crossings in the face of this continued firings of mortars?
Well, what Israel has said all along since it imposed its very tough economic blockade on the Gaza Strip 18 months ago is that it is keen to avoid a humanitarian crisis. It put the blockade in place when Islamist Hamas seized internal control of Gaza, and that is 18 months ago. It's said that the blockade is aimed to hurt Hamas. But of course, it's ordinary families in Gaza who say that they are being hit hardest, with foodstuffs in low supply, fuel in low supply, cooking gas in low supply. And what you see is, at some point, Israel lets in more aid trucks than others. It says it reviews the situation on a daily basis. So if it judges the security situation to be such that it can let the trucks in, like today, it will do so to avoid a humanitarian crisis. Today, a few rockets and mortar shells have been fired from the Gaza Strip, but Israel says because of international pressure and because it wants to avoid a humanitarian crisis, it is allowing these very basic supplies in. But ask the aid agencies and they'll tell you it's a drop in the ocean. It's not enough at all. The last time that any aid came in was 10 days ago.
And in part, the security situation is deteriorating because a truce between Israel and Hamas essentially ended last week. Are there any signs that negotiations or have begun, or that there is going to be some conversations about extending the truce that went on for 6 months?
Well, of course, Israel and Hamas would say they don't speak to each other directly. It was Egypt that brokered the truce that lasted for 6 months and ended last Friday between Israel and the Hamas leaders in the Gaza Strip. It was an imperfect truce at best. Rockets and mortar shells continue to be fired from the Gaza Strip at Israel throughout, although for most of the time to a far lesser extent than before. There were weapons continued to be smuggled into Gaza through Egypt, which is also something that Israel had asked to be stopped. But if you look at it from the Palestinian perspective, throughout that six-month truce time, Israel maintained its tough economic blockade on Gaza. So Gazans say they felt that they were punished still throughout that truce. Yet, if you ask the civilians on both sides, the Gazans and also the Israelis, particularly those who live within the range of rocket fire and mortar shell fire, they say that a weak truce is better than none. And they are hoping that there will be a renewal. There has been talk of it. But when we look at the volleys of rockets that continue to come from the Gaza Strip over the last days, 180 according to Israel's military since last Friday, and the fact that the economic blockade is still in place over the Gaza Strip, it's looking quite bleak. There's a lot also, a war of words going on, a lot of saber rattling on both sides with a lot of threats.
Katia Adler, thank you for that update. Katia Adler is a BBC correspondent based in the Middle East, and she was reporting to us from Jerusalem.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 26th, and Femi Oke has the headlines.
Hello there to you. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Middle East is bracing for a new round of fierce fighting. Palestinian militants in Gaza have stepped up rocket attacks, and now Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warns Israel is ready with a strong military attack if the militants don't stand down. Olmert also expressed some exasperation at the continued shooting despite ceasefire agreements with Hamas.
Telling them now, it may be the last minute. I'm telling them, stop it. We are stronger. There will be more blood there. Who wants it? We don't want it.
Gaza is primarily controlled by Hamas. The U.S. says that a coalition strike on the Taliban killed 11 fighters, and one of them apparently led a bomb-making cell responsible for striking NATO soldiers. Some new numbers out this morning point to deeper trouble in Japan's economy. Government numbers show an 8% drop in manufacturing, and that's the largest drop in recorded history. Unemployment is also now up to 4%. In world markets, well, it was a mixed bag for Asia this morning. European markets are closed today for the Christmas holiday. Wall Street took yesterday off, but traders there will get back to work today. And finally, a record-breaking basketball win streak is now over. The LA Lakers beat the Boston Celtics to end their 19-game run, and Lakers guard Kobe Bryant enjoyed snapping the streak.
Yeah, just from the challenge of it. You know, it's a team that's been playing so well. But at the same time, they did win 19 in a row, so they were due for one kind of malaise kind of a game.
But the Celtics still have the best.
Kind of a game.
They have the best record in.
I have games
the NBA.
Like that.
A malaise kind of a game.
Malaise kind of a morning, you know.
Yeah, a little slow to start.
Yeah, just
not very exciting. Yeah,
lose.
I know. I know what you mean.
Kobe wastes you.
All right, I'm done. See you later.
Thanks very much, Femi. Well, Kobe Bryant's waking up feeling pretty good after the Lakers put an end to the longest winning streak in Boston Celtics history last night. And we got us thinking about streaks. What kind of streaks are your favorite? Let's think about Democrats, for example. Congressional Democrats, well, two election cycles in a row, they've been picking up seats. We want to hear what you think is a good streak.
It's a little small there.
It's a start, though. You got to get to one to two before you can get to three, four, or five. So give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your favorite streak, whether we're talking politics or sports or otherwise.
Or even business. GE used to have a streak of profitable quarters or rising growth quarters. That streak ended in this economic crisis. So, every Christmas, I wish I got a dumpster under the tree, but nobody gave me one because I realize only after you open everything up just how much stuff there is. And how do you deal with the solid waste that's left over from the holidays? You've got trees, you've got wrapping, you've got food leftovers. We thought we'd ask Megan O'Neill, the founder and editor of treehugger.com, who comes to us from Providence, Rhode Island, who's an expert at disposing of all things green. Megan, thanks for being a part of the program, and happy holidays to you.
Oh, happy holidays to you, too. Thanks for having me.
So I need a dumpster to deal with all of the just solid waste that's generated. I got four kids, so you can imagine what the situation is there. But I always feel, as I'm either burning it up or throwing it away, that there's got to be a better way. What's your suggestion?
Well, interestingly, I think what you've just described is sort of a microcosm of what happens in society at large, right? We think about everything to do with a product or a thing until it's time to get rid of it. And the holidays, of course, is when that's most apparent. So, you know, the mostly what we're seeing is we've got, if you're a Christmas tree person, you've got a Christmas tree. We've got tons of paper and packaging. We've got lots of leftover food. So we've got all this stuff, and we haven't thought about it until it's right there and you need the dumpster. And with four kids, I only have one kid, but with four kids, I can imagine it's a lot.
Well, you have thought about it. So let's start with the tree and then move to, say, the paper. And I'd love some suggestions about what I can do in gift giving that would make other people's solid waste problems a little easier to solve.
Sure. Well, starting with the Christmas tree, which is, I think there's something like 30 million of them sold every year. So it's a pretty big waste stream there. The most important thing is that you want to make sure that it's properly disposed of. And that means that it's going to get mulched, basically, and not landfilled. Most cities have a curbside program now, or they have a place where you can bring it and dispose of it properly. What you don't want to have happen is for it to go straight to the landfill, because that means it's going to sit there and rot, not decompose. So it's going to be creating a lot of methane, basically, which is one of the most strong greenhouse gases.
Whereas if you mulch it, it actually contributes to plant growth and therefore produces oxygen as opposed to methane.
Exactly. It's going to get reabsorbed back into a natural system. It's going to help things grow, and that's the proper way to dispose of it.
All right, what about wrapping paper, boxes, plastic, jewel cases from CDs, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, our trash output between Thanksgiving and New Year's goes up about 25% in America.
Oh, my God. That's embarrassing.
Yeah, and then consider that probably one of the biggest waste streams from the holidays is paper from all the things you just described. Paper is actually the biggest contributor to our landfills. It's taking up more than a third of our landfills. But most paper is recyclable. So you really want to get that wrapping paper into the, recycling bin. You want to reuse it. You want to make sure that it's not getting landfilled.
All right, but that sounds like a complete pain because we have to tie up the newspapers in bundles, but how do you deal with folding and disposing of wrapping paper that kids have like torn off of a box?
Well, it probably depends on what the rules are where you live, but I know where I live, we can just shove any kind of paper right into the recycling bin.
And Megan, I recycle all of that. The packaging, the foam that you get, the wrapping paper, it drives my husband bananas. But what I've discovered is if you keep some of the foam and some of the packaging, you can actually donate that to a local organization, particularly any ones that have children and they are involved in arts and craft. And so it's like an extra bonus around the holiday time.
Yeah, you know, it takes a little bit more organization to be able to, you know, to do that in a way that's convenient. But if you're thinking about these things ahead of time, you can really get it together and make sure that the waste is not becoming waste, but being channeled back into what we would call recycling or even upcycling, which is the idea that you're using something for something even more useful or as useful as it once was.
Now, would you suggest particular strategies for shipping, or are there particular items and ingredients in this whole Christmas shipping, shopping business that you would absolutely avoid at all costs?
Well, I think when it comes to shipping, what you want to, I mean, certainly you want to avoid styrofoam packing peanuts, I think would be a big one, but those can be reused. If you're shipping stuff, you want to think about shipping things that are smaller, you know, and packing things concisely so that you're not shipping around tons of air. Obviously, you know, the fuel that's used to ship things is a big deal, whether that's something that's coming from a manufacturer to a retailer or from person to person. So that would be the first thing. And I think for the idea of shopping is, you know, the greenest thing that you can do is buy something that's useful for somebody and that's a quality gift, whether or not it's made from eco-friendly materials. So the idea of sort of cutting down on the crap is a good idea. Sort of
the
first
crap.
Idea when
there.
It comes to
there
when it comes to shopping.
I hear
yeah.
you. Now, what about Christmas lights and Christmas decorations? Are those things recyclable?
Many of them are, and one of the things that we encourage for, you know, the winter holidays and any time is really to decorate with natural materials, which can be composted or aren't just, you know, a lot of plastic stuff that you've got to store, that you've got to, you know, it came from China, that sort of thing, sort of falls into the crap category.
It came from China. Let me just quiz you with something before we go, all right?
Sure.
I got a number for you. 132,903 is the number of what?
That is the number of plastic Christmas trees that are imported from China in a typical year.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm not completely against the idea of the plastic Christmas tree, but what happens is that those are, of course, made from plastic, so that means oil, being shipped from China, more oil, and then really the sad thing is that people aren't using them for very long.
So you
you're going to get a...
If you're saving a tree, if you think you're saving a tree by getting a plastic one, think again. I guess the lesson there is use it for a long time.
Use it for a long, long time, and then pass it on when you're done with it.
And don't let Megan O'Neill see you throwing that thing away until you've used it enough. But Megan O'Neill is the founder of TreeHugger.com, and she joined us to talk about recycling techniques for disposing of Christmas waste. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
She was good with those numbers, huh?
Yeah, she's very organized, just like you are, apparently.
Well, I mean, it just seems like such a terrible waste. You unwrap the gift, and next thing you know. Anyhow, we're talking about streaks. We want to know what your favorite streak is. The L.A. Lakers beat the Celtics last night to end the longest winning streak in Boston's basketball history. What kind of streaks are you into? Politics, entertainment, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or give us a drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
We need to focus on those people we have lost, and we need to reconnect with younger America.
That's David Frum, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, on the future of the Republican Party. And, of course, we're always on. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.